Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. Maths and The Simpsons are not two things that you'd normally put together, except perhaps through the character of Lisa. To most of us, The Simpsons is known best for its comedy, satire, and Homer's love of donuts. But it's actually one of the most mathematical shows ever written, crammed with hidden references, in-jokes, and pure maths tributes. Joining me today is science writer and professional skeptic Simon Singh, whose latest book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, uncovers the maths within the cartoon masterpiece. Simon has a rich mathematical history of his own. At just 9 years old, he declared he wanted to be a nuclear physicist. He went on to do a PhD in particle physics at Cambridge and CERN before moving into science communication with now 5 books and a BAFTA-winning documentary about Fermat's Last Theorem to his name. It's not surprising he was awarded an MBE for services to science communication and science education in 2003. He's also helped to redefine the libel law of this country, winning a hard-fought case after the British Chiropractic Association sued him in 2008 for his article, Beware the Spinal Trap. And more recently, he has expanded on his work in the skeptical movement by founding the Good Thinking Society. Welcome, Simon. How are you doing today?
Not bad, not bad. I should correct just one thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the phrase professional skeptic. It sounds as though we get paid to do it. And there are some people out there who will agree with that. You'll find photos of me, Photoshop pictures of me, coming out of Coca-Cola bottles because somebody's claimed that I'm being paid by Coca-Cola to promote sugar or something ridiculous like that. So, the wonderful thing about the skeptical community, I think, in this country and around the world, is it's full of people who just care about science and care about evidence and care about rationalism and who challenge things because they think it's important. So yeah, I think me and many other skeptics are very, very amateur, but hopefully take it seriously. So, yeah. Slight correction there.
I guess I kind of meant you are skeptical as part of, like, everything that you do.
Yeah, it's part of my day-to-day life, and it actually takes up a lot of my time now. So yeah, no, it's a big... I'll tell you what, I mean, I used to be... all the books I'd written in the past were about how wonderful is maths, or how wonderful is cosmology, or how great is technology. And then I began to realise, as well as saying how great these things are, how great good science is, it's really important to say how terrible bad science or pseudoscience is. So I think now I'm balanced partly towards promoting how wonderful science is, but also challenging pseudoscience. So there's been a bit of a shift in what I do.
Absolutely. And I have to say, when I was 9, I didn't even know what a physicist was, let alone a nuclear physicist. So what first inspired your love of maths and physics at such a young age?
So my family are not scientific at all. So my parents didn't really finish secondary school. They grew up in India. They didn't go to secondary school, really. No one else in my family likes science, let alone it has an interest or qualification in it. But I grew up when people were going to the moon. People were, we had boffins like, Miriam Stoppard and Magnus Pike and Patrick Moore and James Burke, who were on the TV saying that this is such an exciting thing. And I just couldn't think of anything more interesting than exploring the universe or understanding what stuff is made of. And I was good at it. And if you're good at something, then you probably enjoy it and try a bit harder and then you get better at it. And I had really great teachers at school. I had a terrific math teacher, Mr.
Yeah,
Stevens.
Yeah, that makes such a difference.
Yeah. And he stretched us and he never, in our class, we were all good at maths, but I think we all had to struggle every year. So we were always being introduced to new ideas and things that made us a bit uncomfortable. But that was the fun of maths, is that doing maths is a bit awkward sometimes, and that's why you do it.
And that's why it's so satisfying when you solve it or find the answer.
If you're on the soccer team, football team, sorry, you like playing competitive, tough matches. You like training hard because you want to get better and better at being a footballer. It's the same with math. If you want to be good at math, you have to keep on challenging yourself. Ideally from a very young age, from an age where what you don't want kids to do is to get into a position whereby they think they are good at maths because they are somehow inherently good at it. You want them to think that they're good at maths because they enjoy it and they work hard at it and they practice those skills.
And on that note, I believe you've brought the brain teaser this morning to challenge our listeners.
Yes. So the brain teaser. So it's a little quiz, a very, very short quiz. And you have to find out the missing word on this list. So the list of words is this. In this quiz, the list, I'm going to give you five words. The words are coom, and I'll spell that out for you, C-W-M. I think it's a small Welsh valley, C-W-M. Fjord, F-J-O-R-D. Bank, as in a high street bank or a river bank, B-A-N-K. Glyphs, G-L-Y-P-H-S, abbreviated form of hieroglyphs, or and then vexed. But it's the old-fashioned form of vexed, V-E-X-T. I think Shakespeare used that spelling, V-E-X-T. So those are five words in this quiz. They are coom, fjord, bank, glyphs, vexed. And the question in this quiz is, what is the missing word? What is the sixth word in that list?
I'm stumped already.
Okay. I'll give the maybe I'll give you a clue a bit later.
Yeah, we can have a clue halfway through the show. Okay. I think I'm definitely going to get it. We've got producer Miriam behind the desk today. Miriam's going to tell us about the interactive section.
Good morning. So good morning, Science Mixers. Hope you're having a lovely day. For our interactive section today, we're going to be trying a little pure maths ourselves as we attempt to disprove the Collatz conjecture. We want you to get involved as well, though. So all you'll need is your brain and maybe a calculator.
And we've got not one, but two producers with us today. We've got producer Robbie in the studio as well.
Hello.
Good morning. To help us, we need all the brains we can get disprove this. If you think you know the answer to the brain teaser, remember you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. But now, Simon, it's time for your first song. What have you chosen and why?
I now have two kids, so every morning starts with a school run. And we start with one of my favourite songs, I think it goes back to the 70s even, which we play in the morning on the way to school in the car. And it's called Car 67 by Driver 67. It's a terrific song. Lots of the words rhyme in it. Some of the words you don't even have to sing. So hopefully people will enjoy this.
A Google spelt G-O-O-G-O-L is a 1 followed by 100 zeros, and a Googleplex is 10 to the power of a Google. The cinema in The Simpsons is called the Springfield Googleplex Theatre, and this first appeared in the 1990s, long before the company Google was founded, and before anyone had really heard about these numbers.
That's just one example of the many maths jokes smuggled into The Simpsons. I think that's so cool. It's just something that as a kid you're watching it and you don't think twice, and it's only when you then become more aware of what the number is that you can go back and be like, so clever.
Yeah, they're sometimes called freeze frame gags, that unless you freeze the frame, you just don't realise it's there. So if you love maths, you spot them, you get excited. If you don't, they don't get in the way of your enjoyment. And when The Simpsons started in the late 80s, people would... Probably about half of American homes had a VCR, video cassette recorder, this bit of technology that you could use to record TV shows and actually freeze it. So, there are loads of freeze frame gags in The Simpsons, a lot of them mathematical, and only really made possible by videotape technology.
What is your favourite bit of maths in The Simpsons?
My favourite bit... I suppose my favourite bit is the one where I actually noticed that there was maths in The Simpsons, because I'd been watching it for years and I hadn't even noticed it. But there's an episode called The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace. Now, the Wizard of Menlo Park was Thomas Edison, the great inventor. And the Wizard of Evergreen Terrace is when Homer wants to become a great inventor like Edison. And so he's in his basement building all sorts of weird gadgets, weird pointless gadgets. And he's scribbling stuff on a blackboard, as you might do if you're an inventor. And there's, it's just full of maths. Again, you only see it for a second. You have to pause it to really understand what it is. But there's one line that's all about topology. There's one line about the density of the universe. There's one line where he predicts the mass of the Higgs boson. 12 years before it's discovered, he gets the mass pretty accurate. And then there's another line all about Fermat's last theorem. And my first book was all about Fermat's last theorem. And so to see that, it's quite... the most notorious problem in the history of maths appearing in The Simpsons alerted me to something interesting going on. And I'm a particle physicist by training, so I noticed the Higgs mass formula. I rang up one of the writers, or I emailed him, David X. Cohen, and I said, your name is on the credits of this show. What's going on? And he did a degree in physics, like me, and then he... did a master's in computer science, and he'd actually written research papers in mathematics. And he explained that there were loads of mathematicians writing on The Simpsons, people, not just people with degrees in maths, although they're pretty special, but people with master's degrees or PhDs. One guy was even a professor at Yale and gave it all up to become a Simpsons writer.
Wow.
And then they're not mathematicians now, they're comedy writers on the world's most successful comedy. But they still love maths, and the way they express that love of maths is by hiding mathematical references in the show. And they've been doing it for 25 years.
And what do you think is the link? What draws mathematicians to comedy?
There's a lot of them around. Just in the UK, people like Dara O'Brien did physics at maths at University College Dublin, I think. Dave Gorman was doing a degree in maths before... he quit to become a BAFTA award-winning writer and then performer. Ramesh Raghunathan was a math teacher. Paul Foote, there are loads of them. And I have a chapter in the book where I interviewed all the writers. And I said, why do you think you've all been drawn to comedy? And there are various explanations. One of them was that math is about logic and playing with logic and stretching logic and bending logic. And if you break logic and you get to the illogical, that often leads to humour. One of them said it's partly about intellectual stamina. If you're doing a math problem, you've got to think about it really hard for a long time. And writing comedy, you have to think really hard for a long time. One of them said it was like a group activity. We all sit down around a table and we discuss ideas. And maths, people might be...
if it's a common interest, then it becomes kind of...
But also people, I think, don't realise it. Doing maths can be a group activity. People sit around a coffee table and brainstorm and bounce ideas off each other. One of them said that maths in The Simpsons, in particular, said the reason why we've ended up on The Simpsons and not Modern Family or some other comedy is that in animation you have control. Whatever you write on the paper is exactly what appears.
And you can structure all of those like freeze frames, gags and stuff.
Exactly. Whereas if you're filming something, you have to take into consideration the events of the day, the weather, important input from the performers sometimes, the actors. Whereas in animation, you have ultimate control. And it's the same in maths. If you're developing a mathematical proof, you have complete control. Or you have perfection. You don't have the errors of measuring or the errors of uncertainty or the statistical. It's a perfectly formed thing, a mathematical proof. And so it's an animated comedy, ideally. And so there were lots of little ideas, but it's weird. There is a disproportionately high number of mathematicians on The Simpsons and in comedy more general. Why is still a bit of a mystery. Well, the other thing they said was intuition. Uh-huh. If you're proving something in maths, or you're taking on a problem in maths, you have to think, well, can I solve it? If I can solve it, how do I go about doing it? Which path do I take? What path might not lead to a dead end? And that's a very intuitive process. And they said it's like that in comedy. You think of a scenario and you're saying, well, is this scenario going to be rich in comedy? Is it going to take me anywhere?
What's the best way to tell that story?
That's
so
right.
That you get the biggest laugh.
Exactly. Yeah. And so following your intuition, again, people don't think about maths. They think about maths as being very, very logical. The final proof has to be very, very logical. But how you get there is largely a process of intuition based on years of mathematical effort.
And do you think that they were putting them in because they wanted to kind of promote maths to a wider audience, or was it really just for themselves?
I think to start with it was just for themselves, and then as the internet began to grow and there were bulletin boards and discussion groups, with the Fermat's Last Theorem example, they noticed that people were responding to it because the line on the blackboard is seemingly impossible. And so people were getting quite puzzled by this seemingly impossible mathematical line. And when they realized that there was a response, that there was an audience out there for this stuff, they then did start creating it for that small audience that cared and noticed the maths. Because I think they were reaching out to people that were a bit like themselves when they were kids. Because if you're a kid and you really love maths, it can be a bit lonely and it feels a bit odd and different. And so if you're a 13, 14-year-old kid and you see some cool maths in The Simpsons and you know the writers love maths as much as you do, that makes you feel better about what your passion is. So I think part of it is reaching out to people that they used to be many, many years ago.
Was that an experience that you had as a child, being good at maths?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's a good question. I think I went to a grammar school. I mentioned earlier about I had a teacher that really stretched us, and he could stretch us because there was almost a critical mass of young mathematicians who were really keen and interested. So in our group, there were enough of us
that you didn't feel kind of
exactly
like
to support each other, encourage each other, and challenge each other. And I think that's a really important thing. It's actually something I'm working on at the moment to try and recreate that experience for teenagers who are interested in maths.
Yes.
And when I say maths, by the way, I also mean science. You know, I think if you go out there, engineers will complain that we're talking about science engagement and not engineering engagement, and the maths community will complain the same. But you know, I think everyone in this room realises that if you're into maths or physics or engineering, you're in a very separate community to the rest of the world, and that it should really be, you know, if you're good at maths, you're going to enjoy engineering, you're going to enjoy physics, you're going to enjoy all those things. So encouraging mathematics is really also about encouraging scientists more generally and engineers.
Perfect point for your second song. What have you chosen?
Second song is another one, I think, from the car. It's a dictatorship in the car on the way to school. It's one of my favourite groups is Bare Naked Ladies, and I think they did a whole album for kids, because as they grew up, they all had kids and families. And one of the songs on this album is, as the song will explain what it's all about, but it's called, and you'll have noticed, it's called 789, and you'll have noticed by now that all my songs have numbers in them. And this one is called 789.
1, 2, 3, and 4 more make 7. 6 is afraid of 7, 'cause 789. 9 was minding his business, talking to 10 about Gordie Howe's clothes. Why 789? Nobody knows. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10.
What about 9?
789. Oh, the cattle have to live with 8 lives now. Ronaldo will have to make do. Ever since 789, seems I've got an extra finger and an extra toe too. 789.
In The Wizard on Evergreen Terrace, Homer has a midlife crisis and becomes an inventor. Although his inventions are rubbish, on his blackboard in the background, he has nearly predicted the mass of the Higgs boson 15 years before it was discovered.
And now for some equations of our own, we are going to be talking about the Collatz conjecture. Simon, would you like to explain what this is, please?
Okie doke. So there's a mathematician who died, I think, in 1990 called Lothar Collatz. And he made a conjecture, which is childishly simple. You can present it to a 10-year-old or younger, and they can play with it. And the conjecture is you pick a number. Let's pick the number 5. Now, it's odd. If it's odd, you multiply by 3 and add 1. So 3 times 5 is 15, add 1 is 16. That's an even result, so you divide by 2, that's 8. That's even, so you divide by 2, that's 4. That's even, so you divide by 2, that's 2. And that's even, so you divide by 2 and you get 1. And so we've gone from 5 up to 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. And Collatz tried this with some other numbers, and they always ended up back at 1.
Mm. Just following those two rules, right?
Yeah, so 6 is even, so we halve it, goes to 3. 3 times 3 plus 1 is 10. 10 divided by 2 is 5. And five we've already tested. We know five goes back to one, so we know
that you're going to end up at one.
Six, yeah, so it's been tested. I think it's been tested for the first billion numbers.
Whoa.
But they may have made a mistake. And also the thing about math is you have to prove things up to infinity. I suppose that the challenge or the opportunity, the what we're encouraging people to do today is to pick a number and see if it passes the Collatz conjecture. See if it works. Some numbers race back to one, hopefully fairly quickly. Some of them may take a long time. They kind of rise sometimes, and then they fall as they halve, and then they'll rise up again, and then they'll fall as they halve, and then they'll rise up again. So it's sometimes known as the hailstone conjecture, because that's how hailstones are made. They get puffed up into the air, and then as they fall, they gather moisture and size, and they get puffed up again, and then so on. So the hailstone conjecture or the Collatz conjecture, pick a number. I reckon it's worth picking one less than 20, certainly probably less than 100. And
just to save the calculation.
Yeah, see if it does go back to one. And if it doesn't, then you've disproved the Collatz conjecture.
So we've got Robbie and Miriam with us in the studio today. I would like each of you to pick a number, please.
Okay.
And we're going to set you off working out if you can make it come back to one or not. So would you like to declare your numbers?
I'm going to do 17.
17. And why have you picked that one?
It's the day I was born on, 17th of December, so I'm going to go for my birthday.
Lovely. Miriam, what are you picking?
I chose 11 because it's my birthday tomorrow. And
Oh. A very happy birthday. Okay, so we're going to have a race. Who can go the longest, I guess, because how long is it going to take you to get back to one?
Okay. 17 times 3 is, what's that, 51?
Yep.
Thank you, Simon. plus 1, 52, divided by 2 is 26, divided by 2 is 13, times by 3 is 39, plus 1 is 40, divided by 2 is 20, then 10, then 5, and then 5, and we can go back.
Exactly,
yes,
exactly.
Back to 1.
That's it.
I'm still going.
Where have you got
There's
to?
A love...
So I'm like at 26 now, so then divided by 2.
Oh, well, then you're down to 13, and then you're back into the other loop.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lovely XKCD, if people watch the XKCD cartoons.
I love those
But there's
cartoons.
One all about the Collatz conjecture, which shows you all of these loops and connections. So that and the other thing to watch, if people are interested in this kind of stuff, is Numberphile, a YouTube channel.
Their videos are great.
Yeah, it's created by a chap called Brady Haran, and... I think they've had about 300 million views, which is just phenomenal.
Wow.
And so they've got a Numberphile video about the Collatz conjecture and about almost everything else there is. So it's a lovely place to explore, and you'll find things that are pitched at every level. So I've made one about maths in The Simpsons, about the fact that we have 10 fingers, and so we count in base 10.
Hmm.
All the math jokes in The Simpsons are in base 10, but they've only got 8 fingers. They've got eight digits. So why is that the case? So some of them are kind of trivial and fun. There's a lovely one about, is it math or maths? You know, the Americans say math,
God.
We say math.
Yeah.
The age-old question.
And some of them are about really complex math or unsolved problems, like the Collatz conjecture or the Riemann hypothesis.
So,
I mean, that Collatz conjecture... there are people like Paul Erdős, one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century, who said maths is not ready for this problem. We can't solve it.
Isn't the issue that there is no actual written mathematical proof which says which lays down the rule that this will always happen for every number?
For the Collatz conjecture?
Yeah,
no, there's no proof of it. There's no reasoning behind it. And
is that why people say it's unsolved? Because there's no proof.
So a conjecture means that it's an idea that somebody's put forward in math, but it's unproven. Once it's been proven, it becomes a theorem.
Even though they've tested it on a billion numbers.
Yeah, there's something called, let me just think, there's Euler's conjecture, which is a bit like Fermat's last theorem, if people know that. But it just says if you take a number and raise it to some power... I think fourth power, another number raised to the fourth power plus another number raised to the fourth power equals a fourth number raised to the fourth power. And for 200 years, nobody could prove it.
Mm.
And then suddenly four ginormous numbers popped out of thin air and the equation actually can be made to balance. So infinity is a very large space. And even if the film I made with John Lynch for the BBC talks about this. Even if you've checked every number up to a trillion, there's still infinitely many left.
Yeah.
So you either have a proof that's true for all numbers, or it's meaningless, or it's unproven, or it's just a conjecture.
And like some people might say, what is the point of proving, you know, this conjecture that we've just played with? Two very simple rules. It doesn't seem to have any application. What is the point of spending time to try and find out if it's true beyond a billion numbers?
So part of it, I think, is just it's just cultural. You know, what's the point of a symphony? What's the point of trying to understand where the universe came from? You know, a lot of physics is pure and pointless. But it's part of being human. We create incredible music and wonderful poetry and tremendous theorems and great scientific theories. And so we're curious, and it's just what we do, and it's part of being, as I say, part of being human. But the other thing is that these pure physics, certainly, but also in pure maths, these theorems often seem to have practical applications. So Pierre de Fermat came up with a theorem. I think it's called Fermat's Little Theorem, not the last theorem, but the Little Theorem. He came up with that 350 years ago, and that's now used in encryption. So you just never know where these bits of maths will pop up and become useful, in the same way that you don't know which bit of physics is going to become the physics that helps build a transistor or anything else. So mathematicians do it for the love of it, for the passion of it. And I think physicists do their research for the love of it. But the benefits can be very concrete.
And you just don't know further down the line.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I guess if you love it, it's probably really fun. You just get to kind of try and solve puzzles all day.
Yeah, the film.
Or create your own puzzles, like Collatz did. Oh, I'm just going to create these two rules. Can I solve it?
It's a game. It's a game, but it's a game which can be trivial. Collatz appears trivial. But it's also a very deep game. It's that's where the joy comes from. You know, it's fun solving a simple puzzle. That's great. But if you ever solve a really hard crossword or really something that takes you weeks or months or possibly even years, you can imagine the pleasure and fulfillment that comes from something like that.
Yeah, when it beautifully works. What's your third song?
So the third song is another number song. Song probably goes back to my college days. 9 and 9 Luftballon by Nena.
Great tune.
In the episode Marge in Chains, Marge is accused of shoplifting from the Quickie Mart, and Apu is the witness. To prove he has good memory, he claims he can recite pi to 40,000 places, and that the 40,000th digit is 1. This is correct. The writers checked with David Bailey, a NASA mathematician and the world expert on pi.
Absolutely. So, from one proof to another, we have mentioned a few times Fermat's Last Theorem. What is Fermat's Last Theorem?
So, 350 years ago, a mathematician called Pierre de Fermat lived near Toulouse, one of the great mathematicians of history, an amateur, because back then people didn't really have math departments and so on. But he used to work at home every evening. He had a book called the Arithmetica, an ancient Greek text, and he would just go through problems from this text. And one of the problems that was in the text, or certainly inspired by something in the text, was, can you find a cube number plus a cube number that equals a cube number?
Okay.
We can find a square plus a square equaling a square. 3 square plus 4 squared is 5 squared. 3 times 3 is 9. 4 times 4 is 16. 9 and 16 is 25, which is 5 times 5. So square plus square equals square, easy.
And
really.
That's Pythagoras.
That's Pythagoras,
theorem, isn't it?
Exactly. So we learn that at school. But a cube plus
that's
a cube.
How we find the hypotenuse of a triangle.
Exactly, yeah. So a cube plus a cube never seems to equal a cube. And a fourth power plus a fourth power never seems to equal a fourth power. Any power plus the same power never seems to equal that same power again. So the question was, could you prove it? Fermat said he could prove it. And he wrote in the margin of his book.
So could you prove that no other power will work?
That's right. So it's called Fermat's Last Theorem, but it's really Fermat's Last Conjecture. Because although he said he had a proof, in the margin of his book, he said, I have a truly marvellous proof, a demonstrationem mirabilum. He said, I don't have the space to write down the proof.
In the margin.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so he never wrote down the proof, but he left this tantalising comment. So after his death, people found the note. He made loads of these notes. I can prove this, but I've got to go and feed the cat. I can prove this, but I've got to go and wash my hair. He did it all the time.
He's trolling.
Exactly. But in every case, people found the proof, except for this one.
Oh, wow.
And so that's why it's the last theorem. It's the last one that anybody could prove. And people tried for years, decades, centuries to find a proof. And eventually, a British mathematician working in America, Andrew Wiles, now back in Oxford, and now Sir Andrew Wiles, working in the Andrew Wiles building. Wow. So you can tell how big an achievement this was. He found a proof. It took him 7 years and working in secrecy, because he didn't want anybody else to hassle him or to think he'd gone crazy, because, you know, who would have the audacity to take on this huge challenge? The story actually doesn't end there. There's a nasty twist after that. But it's a terrific story. It's one of the great stories in the history of mathematics. And when I was a kid, my math teacher introduced me to Fermat's Last Theorem and said to us, oh, can any of you prove this? And obviously none of us could, because it looks trivial. It looks fairly straightforward.
Yeah, because I suppose if the Pythagoras one works so easily.
Yeah, why shouldn't the others? It's part the book and the story, and I made a film for the BBC about it.
Yeah,
this is
the BAFTA winner.
That's it. It's on iPlayer still. You can still watch it on BBC iPlayer. And if you're overseas, it's on YouTube. But it starts off with Andrew Wiles almost breaking down with emotion, because just the memory of that moment of success, it was the moment he achieved his childhood ambition, because he wanted to prove this ever since he was 10.
Wow.
And so it wasn't just 7 years of work, it was a lifetime of dedication. And so it's about childhood ambition, it's about adult obsession, and it's about the beauty of mathematics. The story kind of covers the history of mathematics, because it goes back such a long way to Fermat, and then even goes all the way back to people like Pythagoras.
And so in The Simpsons, this was the thing that originally caught your attention.
Mm.
They have a false proof of Fermat's Last Theorem?
They have a counterexample. So it actually turns out that there are no numbers that fulfill this criterion. You cannot find a cube plus a cube equaling a cube. You just can't do it. That's what Fermat said. That's what Andrew Wiles proved. But in The Simpsons, it appears that they have a 12th power plus a 12th power equaling a 12th power. And that should not be the case. And the really weird thing is, if you check it on your calculator, it seems to work.
Oh,
wow. It really seems to be a valid solution. But it's not supposed to exist. And that's why it was so. That's why it caused people to respond and to get into a dialogue about it. And what's happening is that it is a false solution. It's not accurate. But it's almost accurate. It's what's called a near-miss solution. And it's such a close approximation.
Is it like 10 decimal places
down
the line?
Yeah, I think
it's even more
like 13. So your calculator, your normal phone calculator, won't see the error. It's because it's so many decimal places down the way. That was a very good example of the writers. Fermat's Last Theorem appears in Doctor Who and Star Trek and a Tom Stoppard play called Arcadia, and in a short story in one of the Stieg Larsson novels.
It appears
everywhere. They just mention it as a throwaway line, but in The Simpsons they do something clever with it. They do something really interesting with it, which is to come up with this fake solution.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. No. When I saw that, that shouldn't exist.
Yeah. So, what is going on? Yeah. Who are these writers? They don't know. And I believe this is the time that we should be giving our clue, because I still have no idea about this brain teaser.
Okay, so this brain teaser or this quiz, there are five words: Coombe, Banks,
Fjord.
Vexed, Fjord, and Glyph. And Vexed, yeah. Mm-hmm. I spelt them out earlier. I won't bother spelling them out again. But
they are on our Twitter.
The spelling is crucial.
Okay.
And if there's time for another clue later, I can give another clue. But the first clue is, it is all about the spelling.
Okay.
Forget the meaning. It's all about the spelling.
Okay, that's helpful. Brilliant. Song number four.
So we had a Bare Naked Ladies song earlier, and I big fan of the Bare Naked Ladies, and the Bare Naked Ladies wrote the theme tune to the Big Bang Theory.
Did they?
Yes, yeah. So that's going to be the next song. But the reason I chose that was that they were reading my book, Big Bang, when they got called about this. And they'd been asked to do theme tunes in the past, and they just didn't really seem very interested, because often you come up with a theme tune and the TV production company doesn't like it. So they weren't really keen on the idea. But because they were reading the Big Bang at the time, they said, yeah, we'll give it a go. And so I kind of... Very proud of that.
So you loved them, and they loved your book. Yeah. So you've done something.
And then when they came
show.
To London, they came. They said, "Well, why don't you come to the show and come to the bar afterwards?" And so, you know, I'm a big fan of theirs. So absolutely love that. So yeah. So next song is Big Bang Theory.
Was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall, we built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a Big Bang. Hey! Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song, a fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate, they tried to leap but they were late and they all died. They closed their asses off, the oceans in Pangaea, see a wooden bar to be a set in motion by the same Big Bang.
In The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace, the fourth line on Homer's blackboard is a series of four diagrams that show a donut transforming into a sphere. This line relates to an area of mathematics called topology. Topology is the study of the properties of space that are preserved under continuous deformations.
Science news!
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 News just in. Renewables provide more than half UK electricity for the first time.
The hottest planet yet?
They've weighed a white dwarf by gravitational lensing.
NASA is set to fly a spaceship straight into the sun in 2018.
Leaning Tower of Cook Pine Trees.
Theresa May's relying on scientific cranks to back her party.
Well, for any of our international listeners who didn't know, on Thursday we had a general election, so I feel we should definitely kick off with that story.
I'd say for people overseas, the Conservative Party didn't get a majority, so they're going to have to rely on the DUP, a party in Northern Ireland, to support them in Parliament. And, I think some of the green policies are a bit cranky when it comes to GMO. Love all the climate change stuff, but GMOs, they seem to be a bit bizarre about. UKIP are bonkers when it comes to climate change. But the DUP, I think they appointed an environment minister who was a climate change denier.
No.
And they had an education spokesman who was a young earth creationist.
What?
So, that's... Not a healthy thing for somebody who has, to some extent, within reach of the levers of power.
Oh, God, the more I hear about this party, the more I'm just like, no. Miriam, tell me about your news.
An exoplanet twice the size of Jupiter is currently the hottest planet ever discovered. So temperatures on the exoplanet have reached temperatures as hot as the surface of the sun.
Wait, what is an exoplanet?
Oh, so an exoplanet is just a planet outside our solar system.
Ah, and it's as hot as our sun?
Well, yeah, the temperatures on there are like really, really hot, as hot as the surface of the sun. So B. Scott Gowdy at the Ohio State University and his colleagues used the kilo-degree extremely little telescope to look for exoplanets passing in front of relatively cool stars. So when a planet passes in front of a star, there's a small dip in the light that's detected from the star, and this is how we can detect planets. So when Scott and his colleagues were searching for planets, they kept seeing planets that had already been discovered. So they tried bigger and brighter and hotter stars. So they detected the hottest exoplanet yet using that telescope. And this is a planet that passes a star that's 650 light years away from us and almost twice as hot as the sun. So that's why this planet is so hot. It's because this star is so hot and obviously heating up that planet. So the exoplanet has an orbit that takes up only an Earth day and a half. And that's why it's extremely hot, because it's so close to that star. And this is the first time they've ever discovered an exoplanet that hot.
Wow, that's really cool. Another space-related story is that NASA announced last week they are going to fly a spaceship
to the surface of the sun.
Yay. I feel like this is probably going to
promote loads of like blockbusters based stories. But it's really, really exciting. So the reason why they want to do this is to take data from the sun's outer atmosphere and understand more about how a star works. Mm. It's going to go 7 times closer than any other mission has ever gone. And we'll be able to then improve our forecast of space weather, which impacts our astronauts and our satellites. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like if they manage to do it, which I'm confident they will, it'd be probably one of the biggest achievements in the history of space exploration.
So cool.
It's really, really cool. Simon, your second story.
Yes, yeah, so when I used to work on Tomorrow's World, I remember doing a story about gravitational lensing, which is this idea that massive objects bend light, or massive objects bend space, and bent space tells massive objects how to move. But I did this story some time ago, and gravitational lensing has always been an interesting topic for astronomers and astrophysicists. But this week they announced they'd been able to measure the mass of a white dwarf by seeing how it bent the light of a distant star.
And for anyone who doesn't know, what is a white dwarf?
A white dwarf is a star that's entering the later stages of its life. And they're not well understood, and their masses aren't properly measured. Often they're in binary systems. They spin around each other. They find another partner that they spin around.
And do a little dance.
And they can weigh those quite well because they can measure how they rotate and so on. This star they just measured is also technically part of a binary system, but it's so loosely attached they don't think that that's
they're
particularly important
other,
no
yeah.
But they earlier attempts to measure it had given slightly odd measurements, which suggested it was really quite massive and maybe had an iron core, and that didn't fit with existing models. But by measuring it with gravitational lensing, by seeing how it's bent the light from a distant star, they've got a better handle on its mass, and it now seems to fit within the theories that they've been developing already.
Wow, that's really very spacey science news this week.
And the DUP are almost on another planet, so we've kind of got the full house there.
Well, my second story was in the wake of Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. I thought we needed some good climate news. And so that's why I was really excited to see that on Wednesday this week, the 8th of June 2017, for all you podcast listeners, the National Grid reported that for the first time ever this lunchtime, wind, nuclear and solar were all generating more power than both gas and coal combined. And that's just brilliant to know how much progress we're making, and you know, renewables are continuing to help us fight climate change. And also as an extra sneaky story, that a UN Ocean Summit recently, four of the major polluters of the sea, China, Thailand, Indonesia and Philippines, have vowed to reduce the plastic going into the oceans. So that's really great as well.
I nearly picked the solar wind nuclear story. It's incredibly important. And you know, it is just one day in the whole year. And you know, it's how do you
steps,
ever store
right?
this stuff? Well, but I think it's the opposite of baby steps, because I think what you need to do is go back 10, 20 years and see where we were. Mm. And the direction of travel is so fast in favour of renewables that this is just a milestone. Mm. But the direction of travel is fantastic. And you know, it's going to happen more and more, and people will start investing in storage technology. And that's obviously going to be crucial in terms of making the most of solar and wind.
Yeah, because they're fluctuating. Mm. It's not always windy. But yeah, absolutely, I just saw it and I was like, smiling away. Yeah. Simon, what is your final song? No, your penultimate song.
So I love the band Queen. Huge fan of those ever since I was tiny. One of their songs is called 39. I didn't realise this until not long ago, but 39, if you're a Queen fan, you'll know the song. You probably know this already, but it's about time dilation. It's about somebody who leaves a planet, and because they're travelling so fast, by the time they come back, all their loved ones are grey and old and have grandchildren of their own. So I hadn't known that, you know, listening to that song as a kid. But yeah, you know, people probably do know that the lead guitarist, Brian May, is an astrophysicist and was doing a PhD when he left to join the band.
I did not know
and
that.
Then went back to Imperial to finish his PhD in space science. I think it was space science. Possibly that's... I don't know who wrote that song, but that... May or may not have been him is a complete answer to that question. So we go.
And the night full day, and the storytellers say that the score brave souls inside. For many a lonely day, sailed across the milky seas. Never look back, never fear, never cry. Don't you hear my call? Though you're many years away, don't you hear?
In the episode Bart the Genius, Maggie Simpson is seen spelling out E equals mc squared with her building blocks. E equals mc squared is an equation in Einstein's theory of special relativity, which states that mass and energy are interchangeable.
That's probably the only bit of maths that I'd ever spotted in The Simpsons on my own. Yeah, go Maggie, little genius. And we fact-checked that song, and it was written by Brian May.
Ah, yeah, and sung by him as well. Yeah.
So, Simon, I want to move on to a little bit more about what you're doing now. Can you tell me about the Good Thinking Society?
Yeah, so the Good Thinking Society promotes good science and challenges bad science. So we've recently, the biggest work we've been involved in recently is with the Charity Commission. Because the Charity Commission has charities on its books, which are highly pseudoscientific, make medical claims that have no evidence. One of them even offers homeopathy in Africa to treat AIDS and HIV and malaria. So we're thinking, well, how can these be charities? Because part of being a charity is you offer a public benefit, and that public benefit has to be evidenced in some way. And we and others have been complaining about this for a few years, and the Charity Commission just haven't responded until this year, when they said we will review the situation. And that review just finished 2 weeks ago. And we obviously submitted to that review, and so did many others. And we're hoping that that will now mean that if you want to be a charity, if you want to have access to public money, if you want the public to give you money, then you need to have some evidence that what you are doing is
beneficial,
doing good. Because obviously that's what we want. So that's the kind of thing that we do. We challenge things that we think are pseudoscientific or anti-science. But then we also do the good stuff too. We promote science. So one of the projects I'm involved in at the moment is trying to encourage kids who are strong at maths to really reach their potential. You know, it sounds kind of elitist. I think more people can be really good at math than we suspect at the moment. I really think that there's much more potential out there. But once children show an enthusiasm and have a confidence in numeracy, then for those strong mathematicians, getting a GCSE A star, or what is now going to be a grade 9, is a kind of a bit of a walk in the park. For a lot of children, GCSE is just too easy. And then they get lazy and complacent and bored.
Mm.
So I'm working with 4 schools at the moment, Plashet and Lister that are in Newham, Bulmersh in Reading, and Ratton School in Eastbourne. And they've created a top set for their 12-year-olds. And this is going to continue through the school. And so in their top set, because they've reached a certain level of ability, they're going to continually be stretched. Mm. So it's the kind of grammar school experience I had as a kid, but without having to need a grammar school, without having to separate kids off into different schools. And I'm hoping, so one of the schools, Plashet, is a girls' school in Newham. And you sit at the back of the class and you see these girls, and they're 12 years old, and they're from all sorts of different countries, they're from all over the world, they're all good at maths, they're all going to get A's and A stars at GCSE. But in this environment, I think a lot of them will really thrive and go off and do electrical engineering at Warwick or aeronautics at Bristol or maths at Durham or wherever. So what I'm hoping is that this program really says, don't settle for an A star. Be brilliant at maths. Be really, really good at it. Because that's where
and
I think
push yourself and really dream big.
When you look at these international league tables, our average students do pretty averagely, which is kind of okay. Where we really fail is not having enough really good students. That's where we, so our level of excellence is very weak. So that's really, and I think it's very important to help kids who are struggling. It's very important to help kids who are in the middle. But I kind of feel those kids that are good are kind of being ignored. And that's where I'm currently putting some effort in, or good thinking is.
It's exactly like in the film that came out recently, Hidden Figures, and Catherine Jenkins is her name, I think.
Yeah, Catherine Johnson. Yeah.
Johnson, sorry, yeah. Having a teacher who was like, she needs to go to this other school and be stretched because she could be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're going to start, I mean, I want to take it beyond those schools and beyond kids that are in the top set. So starting very soon, on Twitter, I'm SL Singh. S for Simon, L for Lemon. Lemon is not my middle name. Singh, SL Singh. And I'm going to be putting out an hour of maths that kids can do every weekend. And so it's to stretch them, it's to inspire them. And one of the worksheets that we offer is based around Hidden Figures.
Oh, wow.
partly to show about the history of maths and the context of maths and it's part of our culture, but also to give them some interesting mathematical problems to think about.
So this is like a kind of maths challengey thing that they can sign up for?
Yeah, so if they follow me, if people follow me on Twitter, when we start, which I think is going to be the last weekend of June, we're only going to run it for 4 weeks, but if it works well, we'll continue it in September. And the idea is, you know, you do your schoolwork, maths, that's great. If you're being stretched in a top set, that's great. But here's some even more maths to kind of
if
inspire
you.
Yeah, want to
keep going. Right. Well, we have just got time left to reveal the answer to our brain teaser. I'm going to use the excuse that I've been doing a lot of talking in this show. I have not solved it. My top guess was like maybe the letters all mean numbers, so they will add up to the same amount. But I didn't get as far as deciding like what numbers or what amount. Has anyone had better luck than me?
I'm stumped. But Robbie, you have something, right?
I think I've got it. I think if you take all the words that Simon gave us, and then you take the alphabet and you remove all the letters that are in the alphabet that are in these words, you're left with four letters. And those are letters Q, U, I, Z, which spells out quiz.
Oh my gosh!
So over and over again, I kept saying this quiz, yeah. Here's a quiz.
Very Darren Brown of you.
But if you take all the letter, the words I gave you and add the word quiz, you have all the 26 letters. It's a pangram of the alphabet. That's
amazing. Simon, it's been such a treat to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
What is your final song?
Last song is 9 Million Bicycles by Katie Mellower. I have a long history with this song that people can look up online. If you Google it, you'll find an article I've written about it in The Guardian. And it's through that song, I have a Black Sabbath number. So I know Tony Moore next has an item called 6 Degrees of Separation. And in you can have a Black Sabbath number, which means that you're linked to somebody who's linked to somebody who's linked to somebody who was involved in Black Sabbath. And so through this song, I have a Black Sabbath number. I also have an Erdős number, which means you've written a paper, who's written a paper, who's written a paper with Paul Erdős. And I also have a Kevin Bacon number, because I was in a TV show with somebody who was in a film, who was in a film with Kevin Bacon. So I have a pretty low, I think it's of the order of 10 or 11, Erdős Bacon Sabbath number. And that's part of the reason why 9 Million Bicycles is here now.
There are 9 million bicycles in Beijing. That's a fact. It's a thing we can't deny. Like the fact that I will love you till I die. We are 12 billion light years from the edge. That's a guess. No one can ever say it's true, but I know that I will always be with you.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.
Science.